You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Historical Blindness, a special episode. This is going to be our first interview on the show. Today I have the great honor of speaking with a researcher and historian whose work has been indispensable to several episodes of the podcast. I relied heavily on his research way back in my episode on the Flannan Isles Lighthouse Keepers, and more recently in my October episodes on Spring-Heeled Jack and the Devil's Hoof Marks. He is the esteemed author of seven books, including very well-received historical works on the origins of the American Mafia, the criminal underworld in turn-of-the-century Manhattan, and the thuggy death cult of India that a lot of people may only know from the film Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Also, in recent years, he's done fantastic work for Smithsonian.com's blog, Past Imperfect, and at his own blog at mike-.com, covering a lot of topics I think that listeners of this podcast would find fascinating. So check out his work there. We'll give links in the show notes. Thank you very much, Mike Dash, for being here.
Pleasure.
So I'd like to just start, if we can, by talking about some of those topics I mentioned. As I said, I relied on some of your research when I did an episode on the disappearance of the Flannan Isles Lighthouse Keepers, and then recently Spring-Heeled Jack, the Devil's Hoof Marks. Those topics that had me seeking out your work, those were topics you researched, I believe, for Fortean Studies. And I was wondering,
back in the 1990s, originally, a lot of them.
I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about quote unquote Fortean research, what that means, and what drew you to do such in-depth research in that field, if you'd call it a field.
I just about guess you could call it a field. For those who don't know, Fortean research is a word that's coined in honor of an American author from the first 20 years of the last century, a guy called Charles Fort, who wrote four books, starting with a book called The Book of the Damned, which were the first to bring together a large number of these sort of strange phenomena that we currently lump together under the overall term of Fortean. Fort had a very specific perspective on all of this, and exactly what that is has been challenged, I think, a little bit over the years. He wrote in a very gnomic style, which is quite hard to penetrate. But fundamentally, the people who are supporters of his work tend to view him as somebody who was actually, in many ways, a super skeptic. He wrote playfully. So he wrote, for example, about the idea of that we're ruled from Mars. He wrote about the idea that things that fall from the sky come from a sort of super Sargasso Sea, as he put it, of sort of suspended in a sort of jelly-like state over the Earth. So, you know, in a sense, he sounds like an absolute classic crank. But the point is, I think, that he didn't believe a lot of this stuff or any of it. He liked throwing out wild hypotheses, in a sense, to sort of show how bad or how challengeable other people's hypotheses were. So if anything, he was an enemy of what he would have called, I think, dogmatic science. So, you know, not perhaps the scientific method, but the idea that we know everything, there is nothing new to discover, we can explain it all. That's really what Fort was out to challenge. And so his inheritors today, who are mainly focused around a magazine that's published in the UK, and which I was a member of the staff of for quite a few years, which is called 14 Times, which appears monthly, continue that work. I mean, so really it's about gathering together material, presenting it, and maybe putting out a few humorous explanations, but not really taking it absolutely, literally, absolutely seriously. And that is a sort of inoculation, if you like, against the dangers of becoming a crank, because obviously the big difference is that cranks believe one thing passionately and are very resistant to alternative explanations or the discovery of information that sort of undermines their pet theories. And so Fortians are the exact opposite of that, or they should be at any rate. And that is really where the word Fortian studies come, the term Fortian studies comes from, and the word Fortian is used in this sort of other blanket term.
Was there anything in particular that drew you to study in this field? Were you always interested in Fortian topics, or?
I guess, you know, from childhood to just, I mean, I absolutely, like a lot of kids, loved mysteries. And like a lot of kids, I started off being fairly credulous and, you know, believing that if someone had gone to the trouble of writing a book about it, they probably checked it all out and it was probably true. Yeah. And of course, you know, I mean, a large number of people, a distressing number of people, never seem to quite make the move beyond that. Yeah. But I think if you read this stuff carefully and with an active mind, eventually you begin to realize that it can't all be true. And in my case, for example, I started off, my main interest I think was in lake monsters, the Loch Ness monster, things like that. And when you get to the point of reading a book, like there's a book by a couple called Janet and Colin Board called Alien Animals, and they had an appendix that listed all of the lakes in which lake monsters have been reported, and there's 268 of them. And I think at that point, you know, you have to say, how credible is it? Okay, maybe it's less incredible that, you know, something could survive in a really gigantic lake like Loch Ness, which is 25 miles long and, you know, 750 feet deep, although it has got a great biodiversity, but I mean, it's a big lake and things could live in it. That's maybe not incredible, but just unlikely. But, it, you know, some of these lakes are not much more than puddles or ponds. It's probably unlikely that these things exist in all 268. But then the next step is to say, but actually, there's almost no difference between the sorts of reports you get from a puddle and from Loch Ness. I mean, it's not as though they are clearly different. And so once you start making inroads down that line of reasoning, you start wondering about the nature of the reporting and the, you know, the personal beliefs of the people who are doing the reporting, the way in which the media approaches it, all these sorts of contextualizing questions, which are vital questions, should, I think, come into your mind. And that's a process I underwent, I guess, between the ages of, I don't know, 14 and 18, 14 and 19, something like that, and emerged at the other end a lot more skeptical than I went out. But it was something that I taught myself rather than being sort of forced through it by somebody else. And so I guess it was a more useful learning experience from that point of view, at least.
Well, I think it's wonderful that even though you grew into this more skeptical mindset, that you don't avoid the topics. I just recently spoke at the Sound Education Podcast Conference at Harvard, and I was speaking about the fact that I think journalists and educators, and I suspect historians also, they will often avoid topics that are considered dubious or kooky for any number of reasons. A lot of times they may be protecting their reputations or trying to cultivate themselves, their reputation as a serious academic. Do you find that to be a case, or has your interest in Fortian topics ever held you back or affected your career or people's opinion of you in any way?
Well, that's a really important and interesting question. And the answer to that, in a sense, is yes. My wife, for example, was very anxious to edit the Wikipedia entry on me that somebody put up because it mentioned all of this Fortian stuff. And she was keen that I was seen as a serious historian and didn't see that the two things could really sit in the same entry. And I think that some people, I mean, I've never been an academic historian at a university, so it doesn't apply to me to a certain extent. I have a bit more freedom than that, although I am a qualified historian. I've got a PhD and I've written history books, but I've never been a university academic. And that, I suspect that, you know, just because the world of academia is small and gossipy and highly, highly competitive, that there will be some people in that sort of situation. And I'm, you know, I think that the key thing, though, that we need to talk about here, and it's, again, it's a vital one for this subject as a whole, is that the reason for that is because a large number of people who don't know the topics very well see them in extremely black and white terms. So you might be asked, do you believe in ghosts? And what they mean by that invariably is, do you believe that ghosts are the spirits of the dead? Do you believe in UFOs? Means, do you believe that UFOs are alien spacecraft? Now, that is actually a very, very limiting way of looking at those two phenomena. Mm-hmm. People who have studied them, you know, are perfectly capable of saying that there is something worth studying in the UFO phenomenon without accepting that we're seeing anything that comes from outside our own atmosphere.
Yeah.
And so what there actually is there's, you know, there are a group of people who are perhaps more likely to be in the science, the sort of hard subjects where there are right and wrong answers to things, are perhaps more likely to look down on this sort of field and be skeptical. In some parts of humanities and social sciences, this type of stuff is actually becoming a lot more studied and a lot more respectable than it is, because once you actually start moving beyond this very black and white view that I mentioned, you can say that a lot of the things that Fortin's study are actually vitally important to sociology, to history, and so on. Mm-hmm. So one of the big things that Fortin Times has done very well, I think, over the years, for example, is it's kept track of what historians and sociologists call moral panics, which is where society gets very het up about some subject which is morally challenging to that society, and it can cause, you know, tremendous amounts of damage when these sort of panics get whipped up. Mm-hmm. The witch trials are often held out as an example of that. Mm-hmm. And more recently, as recently as the 1980s, late early 1990s, the satanic ritual abuse scare.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of people will remember is now seen, with a bit of benefit of hindsight, as a classic example of a moral panic. Now, I was reporting on that for 14 times at the time it was happening, and we took a very sceptical point of view on that and called it as a moral panic pretty much before anybody else did. And you know, when the British government appointed a commission to look into this after the panic had subsided a bit and people were beginning to wonder about the number of kids who've been torn away from their families by social workers who believed literally that satanic rituals and murders were taking place, they appointed a woman called Joan LaFontaine, who's a professor of anthropology. And one of the first people she came to talk to was us, because we had better records than anybody else, actually, of what on earth had actually been going on. I mean, she talked to the police forces and so on as well, but she was very keen to talk to us and to hear what we'd been reporting on, how we constructed it. So there is a certain sort of academic, the sort who are interested in social history, in rumors and panics and things like that, who actually take all this a lot more seriously now than perhaps they did 20, 30, 40 years ago. And so increasingly parts of it are becoming, you know, reasonably academically credible. But I think that for an academic in those sort of fields to move beyond the this is folklore, this is rumor, panic, and the sort of academic labels get applied to it, to say there's something in this, that would be a step that many people, even now, even if they thought it, would probably be very reluctant to take.
Yeah, and it's a refreshing viewpoint. I think it's a shame when people avoid stories like these, because I think as an educator, I use them because they're so good for modeling what's good research, good evaluation of sources, good critical thinking, which you show so much in your research when you're evaluating the secondary literature as well as the primary source material. There's an opportunity to examine the reliability of these dubious sources and to understand how falsehoods get spread, how myths get spread, and you do that really well in your work. There's a tagline on your blog that struck me, history with all the interesting bits left in.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you could speak to that. Do you think historiography shuns good storytelling, or it tends to, that it...
Sorry, please finish.
do you think they prefer that dry academic tone, and is that to their detriment?
Well, I mean, you know, academic history doesn't do all-out narrative. And as somebody who's written popular nonfiction, so in other words, you know, narrative nonfiction, so you mentioned my book on the American Mafia, for example, you know, I'm increasingly aware as I write those sorts of books what a terrible format for proper historical inquiry they are, because the one thing you can't do very well in the middle of a narrative is to break off and evaluate a source and say, you know, this might be not actually true, and let's compare it. Mm-hmm. You know, all of that stuff gets in the way of telling a story. There is also certainly, you know, from the point of view that you're trying to sell books to make a living, some people are anyway, an imperative to pick, you know, if you've got several alternative points of view, to pick the most dramatic one and to maybe suppress some of the stuff that makes it less dramatic. And I've been tempted, at least, I hope I've resisted the temptation, but I've been close enough to it to realise how easy it is to be tempted and how difficult it is to do really good history in a narrative format. So with that said, I think that the best historians are very aware that history and story are very related things. And so even in the most academic works, you'll often, you know, get an opening chapter, half chapter, a chapter opening, which is a little bit of narrative that helps to sort of suck you into the whole discussion and also contextualize it. So I don't think that, you know, historians, academic history and narrative are complete strangers to each other, mm-hmm. actually. But, you know, the subtitle to the blog that you mentioned is really a sort of pushback against the sort of history that's often studied in schools, actually, because mm-hmm. Certainly in the UK, I find it terribly sad, but it's you know, the number of people who say, oh, I don't like history, it's boring, I find quite incredible. I mean, the number of times you hear that is terrifying. And what they really mean is that, you know, they can't relate to it fundamentally, and you know, that they're being forced to learn about people that they don't think of, they can identify with, or are very interesting because they're not like them, and they're being forced to learn a large number of dates. Now, of course, you know, any historian worth their salt would say, well, you know, that's school history. There's a lot more to history than that. Mm-hmm. And what I try to do in the blog and in the books I've written and the work I did for the Smithsonian that you mentioned as well is to show that, you know, history is the most incredible and, you know, by far the most fascinating, for me at least, topic, because it is, you know, full of humanity, and the most amazing and fascinating things do happen, and the most amazing and fascinating people do become actors in these sort of historical incidents. And I also think, actually, and this maybe hooks what we're talking now into what we were talking about a couple of minutes ago, that one of the things that I find about history is that you can learn most about us as humans from, you know, how people reacted in the most extreme situations rather than the most ordinary situations. And so the thing that links everything I've ever written, really, both in the Fortean field and the historical field, is that I'm very, very attracted to these sort of extraordinary times and places and incidents, because I find them revealing as well as because they're exciting to read about.
Absolutely. I agree. I'm wondering if maybe for next couple of questions, I'd like to revisit some of those topics. I know you've written about so much more, but it's those Fortean topics that I have covered on my show. I would love to talk a little bit about, you did a really great job talking about what was really mysterious in the disappearance of the Flannan Isles lighthouse keepers, and then also showing what was probably embellished in secondary literature, what there's less support for, what misunderstandings we have. It seems like the main thing that stuck with you as being very unusual, at least from my reading, was that the occasional lighthouse keeper MacArthur, if you recall, he left his coat behind, but he also shut the doors behind him. Apparently, it seems unusual, since if he was rushing out in a panic because he saw a freak wave washing the other two keepers away, then it wouldn't seem like he would have taken the time to shut each door. So basically, I'm just wondering if you've given much further thought to the disappearance of the Flannan Isles lighthouse keepers, where you're kind of falling on that mystery now.
Well, I think, you know, my general perception of all of these is that, you know, and we'll probably come to talk about them in the other cases as well, you know, there are single incidences which have become very famous because they appear very mysterious. And that's because they're very unusual. But it doesn't mean that they are unique. It means that a certain combination of circumstances have happened to make it harder to explain, you know, what actually occurred. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they are, you know, inexplicable, or that, in fact, you know, similar types of circumstances might not have occurred quite often, that just didn't lead to quite such bizarre endings. I mean, in the case of, you know, to address the specific question you just asked me. We don't know anything really about the exact way in which the lighthouse on the Flannan Isles was left, in the sense that there were probably at least 2 or 3 days between when the disappearance happened and when the relief finally occurred. And the report that was written was not the world's most detailed report either.
Right.
So, for example, you know, we've all gone out of a house and had the door slammed behind us because we left a window open and the breeze has blown through the house. I guess that's happened to everybody. This happened in the middle of a storm. Had there been any window open or broken, or just had the storm sort of, you know, blown the wind around in a circular way, or, you know, who knows what could have happened to that door? It may have been that MacArthur rushed out and did leave the door open or half ajar, and the wind blew it shut. That's at least a possible explanation.
Right.
I think that, you know, I mean, to look at it a little bit more generally, the thing that makes the lighthouse story so impossible for many people to accept as something that has a credible, rational explanation is the mysterious entries in the logbook, which you possibly touched on in your blog, in your podcast, sorry, I'm not sure. For those who, again, who haven't heard that episode or forgotten it, the logbook that was left behind by the lighthouse keepers supposedly contained some very strange and mystical entries about bizarre psychological effects going on amongst the lighthouse keepers themselves.
The crying, God is over all.
Crying, praying, weeping, and also said very explicitly that, you know, they were still there after the storm had finished. That's the thing that, again, a lot of people focus in on, because, you know, it's easy to imagine lighthouse keepers getting washed off a storm-wracked rock in the middle of the Atlantic in the middle of a storm. Much harder to imagine three people simultaneously going vanishing in calm conditions. So what I did, and it was years after I wrote the original paper, I finally managed to solve that mystery by looking into the question of where that particular aspect had come from. And it was possible to track it down, ultimately, to an American pulp magazine called True Strange Stories that appeared in 1929. That's the place that these lighthouse logbook entries were first published.
Mm-hmm.
And this story was written by a man called Ernest Fallon. So I went to a lot of trouble a couple of years ago to try and find out how this story had come into this magazine and who Ernest Fallon might be. Mm. I managed to establish that Ernest Fallon had only ever apparently written one story in his life, which was this one. There is a fantastic internet resource called the Pulp Magazine Index or something, which lists by author everything that's ever appeared in American pulps. And Fallon had only ever written this one thing. So that was pretty weird. And then when you look at it a little bit more carefully, you realize that, in fact, True Strange Stories had this peculiarity that it had a number of people who had only ever written one story and had published that in True Strange Stories. So I looked further into the background and I discovered that this was a magazine put out by a very interesting guy called Bernard McFadden, who was, in some respects, for example, the father of modern bodybuilding and also the father of modern health food eating to a certain extent. He was a weird guy who had a mixture of very, very modern and correct sorts of thinking about the types of food we should eat and sort of, you know, 19th century quackery as well. And he had founded a series of magazines to promote his bodybuilding empire. And then from that, he'd discovered that the thing that really sold best were sort of true confessions type stuff, people writing in about their own personal experiences. So in 1919, he launched a magazine called True Story, which was just a sort of confessional magazine. Which is full of that type of story, and it became the publishing sensation of the 1920s. I mean, very few people seem to remember it now, but it sold more than any other magazine on American newsstands for nearly 20 years, and a whole number of spin-offs came out of it. And of course, the thing about True Story is that, you know, in a sense, the stories weren't true. I mean, they were of a type and were embellished and, you know, ran within sort of very narrow parameters. And in fact, the guy who, well, I'll come on to in a moment, the guy who edited True Strange Story said that, you know, that magazine was launched to see if there was a market for anything other than rape, adultery, and muscles, which essentially was what all the other McFadden magazines were full of at that time. The skeptics at that time, the critics said, you know, this is, it's, I'm ruined journalism was the way they characterized it. You know, you'd done something that had led your life into, you know, everyone else was looking down on you and you couldn't hold your head up in society. You'd had a baby out of wedlock. You had got divorced. You committed a crime, whatever it was. And so those were the sorts of, there was a very heavy moral component to these confessions. So I discovered that True Strange Stories came out of this stable, and I discovered that the editor was another very interesting man called John L. Spivak, who spent most of the period from the 1930s to the 1950s living under a variety of pseudonyms because he was an active communist and was blacklisted during the various red panics of that period. But he had written some memoirs at the end of his life, and he described how, having been appointed editor, he ran into the immediate problem that he needed 18 5,000-word features a month, and he didn't have enough budget for them. And so he decided to write them himself and to earn a bit of extra money during the Great Depression by doing that. And he goes into a little bit of detail in his memoirs about how he did this, which was effectively to go into the New York Public Library and spend a morning doing a bit of research. And, you know, he says very explicitly, all I needed for a story for this magazine was a couple of names, a place, something to hang it on that was true, and then I could make the rest of it up.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, having gone through that process, I think I now understand very clearly why Ernest Fallon only ever wrote one story. It's because Spivak had used it as a pseudonym for that one occasion. And I understand how he came to write about an actual event and write about something really weird and kooky and spooky that nobody else had ever written before. It all makes a lot of sense when you go through that process. So that's good historical research, I hope. And gosh, that was about a 10-minute answer to a single question.
No, that's...
I'm sorry to bore your audience, but does tell us something important, not just about that one incident, but about how these types of stories need to be thought carefully about and investigated and not taken at face value.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you told that story, because I remember when I read your piece on the Lighthouse Keepers that you had tracked down mention of those log entries to the True Strange Tales. But I think at the time in what I had read, you hadn't yet been able to track that further down.
No, well, this is... The great thing about the internet has made my life very different and made a lot of historians' lives very different as well. And what is possible now couldn't remotely have been done when I wrote that story back in 1997, 98. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I went back and I did it properly with new technology, and that made a big difference.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when he did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
So I'm wondering if you, I remember when you, when I read your piece on the Devil's Hoof Marks, the Great Devon Mystery, you were kind of in this place. You mentioned to me actually that you were in the same place as you were when you wrote it, and it seemed when I read that you had concluded that it will probably always remain a mystery because there's such a shortage of primary source evidence in that case. But I'm wondering, you did such a great job of laying out these different possible explanations there. I'm wondering if you have a favorite, or if you lean more towards like the idea if it's a human hoax or misidentified animal tracks or a combination. Yeah.
Well, a combination is most likely, I guess. I mean, you know, to backtrack very slightly, this is a different sort of case to the Lighthouse Keepers ones in that mm-hmm. when I have tried to reinvestigate it with the advent of digitization of newspapers and so on, but no new sources have actually really emerged in the process of doing that, unfortunately. So we are still pretty much where we were when I wrote that back in 94. But I mean, you know, this is another example where you know, the work involved is really clearing away the sort of smoothing over and mystification that goes on in a lot of secondary works. When you go back to the primary sources, it does become a huge amount clearer. For example, the idea that human hoaxes were involved, I certainly wouldn't rule it out, but the the descriptions that you actually see in the primary sources don't make a lot of sense as human hoaxes, because, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, the idea that of a hoax would be, and again, I mean, to look at some of the sources that have come out about this, the most popular theory is that the prints were left by one group of travellers, you know, sort of Romani, to terrify another group who were not believers in Christianity as the Romani were at that point, but believed in a lot of sort of semi-pagan sort of spirits and sort of, you know, witchcraft type of beliefs, and they were called Pikies. Mm. Now, for that to be a credible theory, you have to imagine the Romani going to a lot of trouble to make these prints look spooky, and you know, the way in which they're described in this secondary source by the grandson of somebody who was allegedly involved was very much of that sort, you know, that they were a straight line that went sort of undeviatingly across all obstacles, like, you know, over rooftops, through haystacks and so on. Now, that would be terrifying if true. I mean, you could easily imagine another group of people thinking that only the devil could have made marks of that sort. And, you know, he's apparently dematerialized and walked through a haystack, that type of stuff. Now, those descriptions just don't appear in the primary sources, which refer to sort of crazy higgledy-piggledy groups of tracks that double back on themselves and crisscross and so on. And also, you know, the idea that these tracks went across Devon in a dead straight line for 100 miles is something that only appears in the secondary sources. And when you read the primary sources and do a bit of calculation, the furthest that anyone tracked any one set of tracks, and again, we don't know really how well they did that, is about 4 miles. So not beyond the possibility of it being an animal track or, you know, something like that. And so I think, again, it's very much you just have to get back to the primary sources and see what they tell you. And the reality in the case of the Devil's Hoofmarks is that, you know, the vast majority of the reporting that appeared in newspapers wasn't being done by people who had gone out and investigated this. They were reporting what other people had told them or what they'd heard effectively. And, you know, we're in a period where there wasn't a sort of large newspaper staff who could be sent out to interview people on the spot and investigate. It's, you know, the local papers of that time were one guy and a printer, and they just sort of took what was sent into them from local correspondents or from, you know, picking up gossip fundamentally in their towns. And that is not an ideal way of getting the right sort of depth of and double checking of evidence that you would need to really resolve a mystery. So I'm still, unfortunately, in the place where I don't honestly think that we're going to solve that particular case in such a way that everyone will agree that that's the solution, at least.
You know, it's funny, though, that the Flannan Isles lighthouse keepers and the Devil's Hoofmarks and what I want to talk about next, the Spring-Heeled Jack story, it seems like people in all of those cases, the way that the stories have been embellished, a lot of times they end up being embellished by people suggesting they have to do with aliens or UFOs in nearly every case, right?
Yes.
And then that's one of the things, that's one of my favorite bits of your research. My favorite piece was the Spring-Heeled Jack work that you've done. And I saw a couple of trends in that I run into all the time, just in my own little show and, you know, my modest look at these kinds of topics. And so I wanted to kind of talk about Spring-Heeled Jack and these two trends that I tend to see in how stories get embellished. One, I think, has to do with a relationship between sensational media, unreliable newspaper reportage, especially back in the 1800s, the spread of the spread of urban legend or hysteria, which these are both things that you've talked about. Those the forces, they seem to feed into each other in my experience, and then they end up creating these legends that persist even today as mysteries. I saw it a lot when I was looking into the phantom airship sightings across America in the 1890s.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it seems it's unclear whether, to me, and it's probably a combination, but whether it's people spreading falsehoods or they are deluded, they are mistaken when they make eyewitness reports, and this results in fake news or maybe even earnest news reportage based on false reports, or vice versa. Newspaper hoaxes are touching off hysterias, which then results in further fake news. And I, Yeah, I know that you probably have a lot to say about Victorian newspapers. I've heard you talk before about researching in Victorian newspapers, and you wrote quite a bit about how the Spring-Heeled Jack is a perfect example of like a proto-urban legend. So I was wondering if you could speak to this relationship between hysteria or urban legends and then newspaper reports and how they spread these kinds of stories.
Well, I will, but I mean, I'll just back off slightly just to make the point that you're absolutely right in saying that there are two forces at work here. And you just have to look very carefully and critically and see them at work. You know, and I'll come back to this. So at the time, the reporting was not ideal. Since the time, the story has been picked up by secondary sources and, mm-hmm. you know, recycled and polished within an inch of its life. And given, therefore, sort of mysterious elements that can't be explained because they've taken away all of the sort of uncertainty and, you know, miscellaneous bits and pieces of information that don't quite fit and crafted it into a single narrative that can't really be assailed if all you've got is a secondary source. And Spring-Heeled Jack is a fantastically good example of this process, which underpins 90%+ of all of the way in which, you know, the average person who only reads secondary sources views every sort of strange phenomena. And either you become an outright skeptic because it's also obviously ludicrous, or you become an outright believer because, you know, it can't be, you know, there's nothing that can possibly be explained about this. So in the case of Spring-Heeled Jack, for example, it's often said, you know, the same basic figure appears in London in 1937 and disappears in Liverpool in 1904. You only have to do a bit of basic maths to work out it can't possibly be a human being because nobody could remain active over that sort of period. But the stories are supposedly the same. You know, the idea of this sort of, you know, that Spring-Heeled Jack has been seen doing these preternatural leaps that no human being could, that he breathes these giant gouts of fire to everybody all the time across this whole period. It's absolutely just not true, but it's in every secondary source that there is. And so if you just basing yourself on that secondary source, of course you're going to either say, well, it's got to be a load of rubbish because it's so incredible, or it's got to be true because it's so incredible. You know, the nuance is to go back to the contemporary sources and see what they actually say. And, you know, I mean, the published version that you have read is dates back now over 20 years. And I feel quite embarrassed by it because this is my big sort of lifetime project, and I've spent a long time. And obviously, again, with the advent of digital newspapers, a lot more has become possible. So just to give a very basic example, I put a lot of effort into reading those Victorian newspapers mm-hmm. on microfilm in the British Newspaper Library to write my first paper. And I would not recommend it to anybody because newspapers in that time were all published in sort of giant blocks of 6-point type with no illustrations and no headlines. And to read it on microfilm on a tiny little screen, Quinty microfilm reader, while simultaneously being anxious that you're missing something, is not very pleasant. And to do that for weeks and weeks and weeks on end, as I did, is a very unpleasant experience indeed. But having done that, and I started work on this in January 1983, and I published my first results in 1996, so I've been going about 13 years by that point, I had 45,000 words of source material from primary sources, newspapers mainly. Now, and with considerably less expenditure of effort than we have keyword searchable databases, I have over 350,000 words, so nearly 10 times as much.
Wow.
That is an example, and that's discarding all the duplicates, of which there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stories that appeared in many, many newspapers, and I've only used one. So, I mean, that's a lot of material, a lot. And it's plenty to see that... Spring-Heeled Jack is essentially a label that is, for much of this period, just applied to any sort of certain sorts of ghost reports, fundamentally, where the ghost is uncatchable and appears to be elusive or, you know, vanishes before it can be caught. Certain sorts of street crime, particularly assaults on women on mm-hmm. sort of dark street corners from somebody who leaps out at them. All of those things get labeled Spring-Heeled Jack stories. And when you go back to and read the original newspapers, it becomes immediately obvious that we're not talking about the same person or monster or alien appearing in various different places across 60 or 70 years. We're talking about a label that's been very lazily in many cases applied. And in most cases, these stories have almost nothing to do with the original Spring Hill Jack stories that date back to 1837-38 in London, and which do in fact feature some of the things that Spring Hill Jack's famous for. So there are, you know, I mean, the label itself, which implies this incredible agility, is there. There are at least two or three reports in which Spring Hill Jack did apparently breathe blue and white balls of fire into the faces of his hapless female victims. He was reported to be wearing bizarre iron claws and to have scratched and clawed at his victims as well. He, you know, there are these weird stories of sort of shape-shifting that he's seen in the form of a monster, as a sort of white bull, as a giant heifer, as a giant baboon, and also as a sort of, you know, a spirit clad in armor, like Hamlet's father's ghost, for example. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of different guises that he has in that very early period, and of course as a demon, effectively. I mean, that's what the real Spring Hill Jack is. Real, probably not very effectively then, into sort of verbal inverted commas, you know, is effectively a demon. And that's why he breathes fire. I mean, it's what demon, you know, he comes from hell. Of course, he breathes fire. When you look at it from that view, it becomes obvious. So there are these reports. But again, when you look into it and read it very carefully, the things they're applying here that I mentioned with regard to the devil's hoof marks. So, you know, and I have done a lot of work that I hadn't done back then, and I've had help from people who know more about this than I do as well, about how Victorian newspaper reporting worked. And very basically, even the biggest papers at the time, and the Times, for example, which is still going, it was the biggest then, had very small staffs. The Times had a full-time reporting staff of 12 people, and I think 10 of those were parliamentary reporters who just sat in the House of Commons and wrote the speeches down. So, you know, nobody had a core of reporters who went out and investigated this stuff. All of the crime reporting and a lot of the Spring Hill Jack stuff comes from reports from police officers where, you know, people who've had these experiences go and talk to magistrates. All of that comes from a sort of freelance reporter called the Penny a Liner, who were notoriously liable to exaggerate stories because they were paid a penny a line. And the more exotic stories were, the more lines they get in the newspaper. And they were certainly also not above repackaging old stories. So one of the curious things when you look at it carefully that you can say about Spring Hill Jack is that he appears when Parliament is in recess, so when there is space to fill in newspapers. And at that time, you know, penny a liners would make more money. And if nothing was happening, they would demonstrably recycle old stories. So you can find examples, for example, of, you know, murders that are reported that, you know, a 20-year-old murder is repackaged, given a slightly different scenario, a different name, and published in the newspapers. And when you look at, and again, it's easier now to do it, you can trace back examples of Spring Hill Jack type stories back as far as 1677. And regularly from 1804, these types of stories appeared in the British newspapers. They weren't called Spring Hill Jack stories, but they featured characters with those same some of those same attributes. So again, I mean, you know, I'm perfectly aware that they will be sort of, you know, out and out believers will just say, well, that just proves the case. It's the alien was there than we thought. But for me, it's more that, you know, this is a type of story. It's a piece of some sort of folklore, fundamentally, which is repeated. And, you know, what's interesting about the 1837 case is it just catches fire in a better way than some of the early ones. But there's not, again, to go back to my point about the lake monsters in the very beginning of the show, there's not a lot that distinguishes the Spring Hill Jack of 1837-38 from the various monsters being reported in 1837, 1826, 1825, 1824, 1810, 1809, 1804. And as I say, you can go back then to 1677 and find very similar stories published in pamphlets from that period as well.
And I like how you say that the story caught fire, because when a story, you know, if it's sensationalized or spread by these people looking to fill space or earn the penny a line, like you were talking about, if that story catches fire, then that might result in the readership of the newspaper starting to believe that they see it, or wanting to be a part of the story and claiming they see, you know, Spring Hill Jack or, you know, mystery airships or whatever it is. And it seems to start this chain reaction.
So one of the things that's very noticeable about the newspapers in 1837 that perhaps doesn't apply as late as 1898 is that the people who see Spring Hill Jack are not the people who read the newspapers or buy the newspapers. In the 1830s in England, the government still tried to control the spread of information through newspapers quite seriously. So they applied something called the stamp tax, which essentially meant that newspapers couldn't be bought for less than about sixpence, which at that time was like half of the weekly wages of the average sort of ordinary artisan. So they weren't the people buying newspapers. They couldn't afford them. So what you actually see in the papers at that time, people sort of rather sniffily talking about servant stories and the you know, reporting what their servant had told them about what people were saying about Swing Heel Jack. So you're getting it at this sort of one remove, effectively. And that's vitally important to understand. So there is a sort of rather a sort of translucent, semi-opaque window that descends across what actually happened, because you're getting this sniffy secondhand reporting. Mm-hmm. Now, there are two exceptions to this. The first thing I'm going to just tease, because I haven't published it yet, there were a number of pamphlets published at that time that were mass circulation because they weren't part of the stamp press and do probably tell us what people were saying about Spring Hill Jack. The problem is that there were only three surviving examples and they were all destroyed by German bombing in World War II. But in the course of my research, I have been able to find a few scraps of information from stories written by people who had read those pamphlets and reported a little bit about what they said. And I have got enough material now to reassemble in fairly good detail what those pamphlets originally reported. So when I finally publish my big book on Spring Hill Jack at some point in the next couple of years, there will be some interesting material in that that nobody's seen before about what was really going around. And it's not the sort of Spring Hill Jack that we see in the secondary sources, who's a leaping demon alien type at all. But I won't go any further than that for right now. And the second thing to say is that the reports that are at the center of this do involve, at least in one case, people who come from this ruling class. So the famous Spring Hill Jack report, I mean, and without which we would not be talking about Spring Hill Jack now, almost for certain, involved a girl called Jane Allsop, who was 18 years old and lived in a little cottage with her parents on the eastern outskirts of London. And she was the one who gave this report to the local police office the day after it happened, talking about how she had gone, you know, there had been a violent ringing at the bell, that she had gone out with a candle. Spring Hill Jack had been standing at the end of the lane, had assaulted her, dragged his iron claws over her, ripped her dress half off, and then breathed these blue and white balls of fire into her face. Now, you know, I mean, I do not say that I can explain every single thing that's ever been written about Spring Hill Jack. If Jane Allsop is telling the truth about what happened to her, at the very least, we've got a very peculiar Spring Hill Jack imitator or something around doing all of those things and apparently getting away with it. But again, if you look very, very closely at the sources, there are some things that you notice. Firstly, whoever this attacker was, assuming that he existed in the first place, he didn't leap over the house to escape or bound away into the darkness with 50-foot leaps. He scampered away across the fields. Those are the exact words of the newspaper report. Okay, there was also a witness in the lane at the time, which, again, the secondary sources never mentioned him because it wasn't in the one report that got picked up and turned into, you know, books and then picked up by the secondary sources. You've got to go and read a whole load of old newspapers. But there is a witness in the lane who says, I was 100 yards, 80 to 100 yards away, and I could see this incident happening, and I did not see any blue and white balls of fire. So, you know, if there were blue and white balls of fire, they aren't the sort that we imagine, as sort of, you know, giant gouts of fire like a fire eater at a circus. It might be possible that Jane isn't lying, because I met a magician who's a specialist in the history of magic, who told me that magicians at that time used a technique involving sort of wads of cotton soaked in a sort of alcohol, which they could breathe out fumes into a lit, a fire source, and that would give very localized fire. That if you were 4 or 5 feet away, you would see a ball of flame. If you were 80 yards away, you wouldn't see a ball of flame. That seems to me to be a very credible possible explanation for this, because the one thing that you do notice, being skeptical and reading carefully about the two Spring Hill Jack reports that involve breathing fire at this period, is that in both of those cases, there was a source of fire available. Jane went and got a candle and she handed it to Spring Hill Jack, who held it up under his chin just before he breathed fire in her face, for goodness sake. So, you know, I actually do tend to think that there probably was something in this fire breathing business, but it was very much of the magic trick type of variety. And the imitator, the person who's been inspired by all this newspaper coverage to go and do some mischief. Now, again, I know I've been talking about 20 minutes, so I'll just very quickly finish and say that another thing that comes to you when you read as much Victorian newspapers as I have is just how bored people used to get in the evenings in that period when, you know, not, there weren't even that many newspapers around, no radio, no television, no computers. The idea of playing the ghost, as it was called, going out and committing and pranking people, was surprisingly widespread. There were dozens of these guys leaping out with sheets over their heads and trying to scare the neighbours and so on. And so, you know, the idea that somebody would prank based on the Spring Hill Jack reports is a very, very, very credible idea indeed, as far as I'm concerned.
Sounds like Halloween fun, except for the incidents that are awful assaults, of course.
Yeah, or indeed that lead to people getting killed because they've been mistaken for ghosts. That's happened in Hammersmith in 1804 when someone was shot dead for playing the ghost.
So another trend that I saw, and what I loved so much about your work on Spring Hill Jack is it seems almost like a microcosm, like a test case for a lot of the stuff that I see when I'm researching my show all the time. Besides the newspaper reporting, besides the unreliable witness testimony, and the secondary literature that you're talking about and how it's been exaggerated, what I tend to see is folklore showing up, or similarities to folklore, and it muddies the waters. When I was researching the green Children of Woolpit, I was, of course, dealing with a lot of different folk traditions there. One thread of that led me to the Babes in the Wood nursery rhyme. It also sent me off to see if there was some influence, but from the Princes in the Tower story. But I was also finding connections to ancient fairy tales about exposed children that seemed to link these stories to, you know, folk traditions that are similar to Snow White. Or I did an episode about the White Lady, a German ghost story, basically, and I found myself going down this rabbit hole that suggested all of these different White Lady ghost stories were born out of some old goddess mythology, goddess traditions. So I know you found some folkloric threads in the Spring Hill Jack legend, and you mentioned some stories that they seem like they're popping up independently almost in multiple cultures. And I'm wondering if you could speak to the relationship between the folkloric traditions, folklore, and how genuine events sometimes become embellished by folklore and become legends.
Well, it's a...
I know, it's a big question.
No. Well, what I was going to say actually was, this is really where, you know, academia needs to catch up with my own interests. I mean, you know, folklorists are aware of these types of things, but they haven't really spent as much time as I would ideally want studying or theorizing about them. So there are two aspects of folklore that are what you're describing. Firstly, there's a thing that folklorists call ostension, which is folklore turning into reality, often with people sort of acting out stories. Now that's, you know, what we were just talking about with Spring Hill Jack is effectively ostension. That's relatively well understood and documented. Folklorists also have this rather useful term, the migratory legend. And that's the sort of thing you were just talking about, where the same sort of story crops up in different places and different times. But they do not have a mechanism to explain how and in what circumstances stories migrate. And that is frustrating the heck out of me, because what we're seeing is, with the case of Spring Hill Jack, I mean, again, it's possible now that I've been doing it for 30 years and with the internet to see that the same sorts of stories crop up outside the UK and outside the 1837-1904 time span that we're looking at. And this is completely fascinating to me. You get Spring Hill Jack reports from Newfoundland, where he's called Spring Hill Jackson, in fact. Jackson. You get them from Australia, you get them from New Zealand, you get them from South Africa. All of that is very, very clearly explainable because these are parts of the former British Empire. British people emigrate to those places. Newspaper and pamphlets and penny dreadfuls move from Britain out to those places. So I can understand how Spring Hill Jack stories occur in places like Australia, but Spring Hill Jack stories also occur in Russia at the time of the Russian Revolution in St. Petersburg. They occur in Somalia in the 1980s in Mogadishu during the warlord period. They occur in Czechoslovakia during World War II, where there's an incredibly Spring Hill-like Jack character called Perak, the Spring Man, who's terrorizing the German garrison of Prague. And I have never been able to explain how those stories crop up in those places. They are not called Spring Hill Jack, but they are clearly the same story. And nobody, no folklorist, no researcher of any sort I've ever spoken to, and I have tried, has been able to credibly explain why the same story would crop up in such weirdly different places and times, and how it could migrate, and in what circumstances, and via what mechanisms. And I'm still baffled by that, but something is going on there that none of us really understand, I think.
Well, that's just fascinating. Thanks. Thank you so much for the interview. I think that's really all I had, except for the last thing is if you had any particular project. I mean, you mentioned that you are hoping within the next couple of years to publish all of your Spring Heeled Jack work. So I really look forward to that. But is there anything else you're currently working on, well, that you want to share?
Sure. I mean, my problem is I'm a very curious guy, and I read a huge amount. And I listen, and I pick up stuff all the time that fascinates me. And I have, you know, when I was with the Smithsonian, they paid me to write an article a week for their magazine's blog, history blog. And it was a wonderful time for me because I was being paid to investigate and write up something. And I had to do it in a week, which is actually a very good discipline for me. Because what I tend to do when I'm not in that sort of deadline is just research and research and research. And I've got around about 3 or 4 years backlog of research material I haven't had time to write up, and probably at least 30 or 40 of these stories and articles that I need to write. Mm-hmm. So a lot. Some of them aren't 40 and they're just mainstream. Well, I'll never do mainstream history. They're just history. But the thing that probably crosses over and which I've devoted the most attention to and I'm most excited by, because it has got a lot of fresh material in it that I've managed to unearth, is sin eating. I don't know how many people listening to this have ever heard of sin eating. This is the concept that when somebody dies, a sort of local reprobate, some sort of outsider from the village, and this is something that happens mainly in Wales and the Welsh border in the UK, but has been reported in places like Appalachia as well, in fact. Anyway, that somebody dies and this person will be called in, and the corpse will be laid out, and the family will put a piece of bread and some salt on the chest of the corpse. The sin eater comes in, he eats the food and drinks a draught of ale and says that it's an incantation. And in doing that, he takes on all of the sins of the deceased onto himself so that this person can then, the soul can go to heaven, cleaned. But of course, the sin eater becomes more and more and more burdened by this sort of massive sin that he's taken on over his lifetime of sin eating, and becomes ever more excluded and feared by the local community. Now, this is something which is a very, very vivid story, and it turns up in a lot of fiction. Patrick O'Brien, who wrote the Master and Commander series of naval books about Aubrey and Maturin, one of the members of his crew is a sin eater, for example. There have been a couple of books written by American Christian writers about sort of brave evangelical priests throwing the sin eating superstition out of communities in Appalachia. And, you know, I mean, it's not uncommon. Heath Ledger starred in a movie about a sin eater at one point. But again, as is the case with most of my stuff, there's a very, very small amount of material that actually relates to genuine cases, supposedly, of sin eating. And all of it has been written by outsiders. Some communities apparently had this practice. So we have all of the sorts of things we've been talking about where the reporting is dubious, there's a limited amount of information, it's uncertain whether it ever happened properly at all, ever. And I've been devoting a lot of effort to try and work out what really was going on in Wales between about 1600 and 1850, and whether sin eating ever really did exist. And with that one, I have found some new information in the Welsh language archives, which is quite exciting. And I'm hoping to publish something on that next year as well. So that will be a bit less of a monster project than Spring Heeled Jack.
Well, sounds very interesting. So I'll look for that as well. So again, just thank you so much for doing this. This is actually my first interview that I've done for the podcast Historical Blindness, and I consider you a good get, as they say. And it's a great interview. So thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure, and I'm sorry to have gone on such inordinate length.
Oh, no. My listeners will appreciate it. I appreciated it.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good to speak. And good luck with the podcast going forward as well.
Oh, thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Mike Troy, host of the American Revolution podcast on the Airwave Media Network. This podcast is the origin story of the United States, how we went from colonies ruled by a king to the democratic republic that we have today. The American Revolution podcast tells the story of the revolution from beginning to end. Please subscribe for free. We're available on all major podcast platforms. I hope you will join me today on the American Revolution podcast.